This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, October 1st, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. China has effectively prohibited transactions in cryptocurrencies, seeking instead to try to compel citizens to stick with the central government money. Meanwhile, U.S. regulators continue to wring hands and lean into regs to squelch the financial innovation that crypto represents. Cato's George Selgin comments. When I had heard news that China had effectively prohibited transactions in cryptocurrency, it was paired immediately with Bitcoin was down 5% on the news. And I thought, well, that's just another day in the life of Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies. So is there a broader effect or just how do you evaluate the effects of China saying no to crypto, essentially?
Well, if you mean the effect on the value of crypto, you've said it. you look at the price, and I do think that China's action is the reason for that particular slide in Bitcoin's price, because of course China's a big country, and a lot of people there contribute to the demand for Bitcoin. So this is bound to have a chilling effect, and it's also having a chilling effect because it might bode badly for the prospects of Bitcoin being treated nicely elsewhere. But one may hope that China's example isn't widely followed. As for the real most serious consequences of China's action are more symbolic for most of us, but they're very serious for the Chinese people, because it's part of a broader endeavor to concentrate all payments in the People's Bank of China and make it the one source of payments media, and that in turn will allow the Chinese state authorities to snoop more effectively, if not quite systematically, on all of their citizens' financial transacting. So that's a big deal.
To the extent that policymakers in the U.S. Look at this decision and are looking for a path forward with respect to crypto broadly, maybe it's just me, maybe it's my previously held beliefs looking into the prism of this event. But it seems to me that this would strengthen the case for not regulating crypto, at least not harshly, in the United States.
Well, it all depends, Caleb, because I'm afraid we have lots of people here, including regulators, for whom any stick is good enough to beat cryptocurrencies with, and they're not necessarily disinclined to treat China as a precedent and even as an example. So, to go back to the China's general program, one of the other elements of it, banning Bitcoin is part of it, but the other part is introducing a Chinese central bank digital currency, so-called, which they will be the first country to do, and they're in the process of launching it, and of course that means being able to track transactions of anyone who uses that currency. So they're crushing the private alternatives, not just Bitcoin, but some others as well. And they're creating a centralized alternative. And yet, that second step hasn't caused American policymakers to say, oh, whoa, you know, we don't want to do what China's doing. As we can see, this is very oppressive. On the contrary, people are in government and elsewhere here in the U.S. are pointing to China's move to establish central bank digital currency as an example that we should follow. Well, they're saying, Lael Brainard, for example, is saying, well, you know, if we don't do it now, we're going to fall behind. And that's become an argument for various U.S. monetary policy innovations. It's the argument that if other countries do it, we better do it because we don't want to fall behind, no matter what country and why. I find this really quite repulsive, to not put a too fine a point on it. It's not an argument at all, unless it's a bad one.
So if George Selgin were suddenly the head honcho policymaker in the United States with respect to cryptocurrency, you care about innovation. You care about the development of infrastructure around these relatively new tools that are nominally currencies, but are also tools for achieving other ends in financial markets and on the internet. I would think that you would say, look, if you want the innovation to be here, you have to let it grow.
I have said that, Caleb. I've even written it. Of course, that is my view. And it's not just about, or even primarily about, Bitcoin. It's about other kinds of, shall we say, high-tech payments media, digital, of course, but even bank deposits are digital. But here I'm talking about payments media that you can use without having to have a bank account. That sort of thing can be done, and in many places is being done, is being provided by private sector fintech firms, as we call them, and very successfully. We haven't had as much success. That is, we haven't had private sector innovations proceed as far here, mostly because we, our government agencies, including the Fed and other bank regulators, have not been so willing to facilitate or enable the private providers of alternative payments media to do the very things that some of those same regulators want the Fed to do by issuing its own digital currency. But in fact, there's nothing the Fed can offer that the private sector couldn't offer, with the crucial difference that if we open it up to the private sector, if we enable the private sector, if we give these firms access to the Fed, which would help, for example, then the private sector could do it more efficiently. There's no question about it. And they would continue to innovate. And we cannot count on the Federal Reserve, given an exclusive right to issue digital person-to-person payments media, to go on innovating in the future. And people should ask themselves, how come central banks have this bright idea of issuing digital currency? Well, it's because the private sector did it first, and now they want to muscle in, typically. But who would do the innovating once they muscle in? That will have a 100 years from now, we'll have a horse and buggy digital currency, the same way today we have horse and buggy paper currency, because central banks are such poor innovators. You have to wait for some private firms to challenge their monopoly. Then, eventually, they get the idea of copying them and then taking over.
So what are the concerns that regulators have, and how legitimate are they with regard to so-called stable coins? There are several of these out there that are essentially pegged to the dollar. They're worth a dollar. They spike to $1 sometimes, mm-hmm. and or dip more to 99 cents or mm-hmm. a little more around the edges. But for the most part, they just move along in a pretty straight line in terms of dollar-denominated value. What's the problem with that?
Well, some of them are more volatile than others, Caleb. But as you said, they're sometimes they trade at a premium, not at a discount, and then the premium could actually be pretty high. Well, the reason these stable coins exist, first of all, is mostly to assist cryptocurrency trading and to do it more expeditiously than is possible under present arrangements, including arrangements that consist of government barriers to using ordinary means of payment, private means of payment for cryptocurrency. They're more efficient alternatives, and partly they're more efficient because they don't take any time. You can transfer cryptocurrencies, you can buy and sell dollars, you can buy and sell other currencies with them instantly, anytime, any day of the week, with using stable coins. Whereas for most other payments, the ordinary private dollars like bank deposits, you're very limited in when you can get a quick transaction for all kinds of reasons, almost all of which have to do with regulation. So that's we've created, our regulators have helped create, and other countries too, have helped create the market for stable coins. But to get to your more basic point, They're not particularly dangerous. It's another bad argument that government regulators have come up with. I mentioned the argument that, oh, if other countries do X, then we don't want to fall behind. That's a crappy argument. But then the other argument you're hearing now is, well, these things are like old-fashioned banknotes of the Wildcat banking era, or they're like money market funds that gave us trouble a few years ago. And that's it. These analogies, this kind of argument by analogy, is the other main argument for trying to suppress cryptocurrencies, but especially stablecoins. And it's also not a good argument. They are fundamentally different. They're different in the way they're used, why people want them, and ultimately what sustains demand for them. For example, last year at the outbreak of the COVID crisis, you had runs on money market funds because they still hadn't reformed those correctly. And so we saw a little sign of them being still dangerous despite some post-2008 reforms. But if you look at stablecoins, people were running into stablecoins. They were safe. They were safe havens. In fact, the premiums on some of the most notoriously supposedly unsafe stablecoins like Tether went way up. They shot up. So I think the point here is you can't just treat these things as being like other financial assets that have proven occasionally under certain circumstances to pose some risk to financial stability. You've got to look at them for the unique things that they are and ask what risks they pose. And I think the more people do that, and I hope regulators will get around to it, the more they'll find that there's a pretty robust demand for these things. There are reasons why runs on them that cause them to really lose value are actually quite relatively rare. That's the sort of thing that I hope will happen more, that people will try to, you know, calm down and stop using any old argument to suppress these private innovative currencies and look at how they actually work and how much danger they really pose, which is often much less than what people are saying.
So you mentioned the value that they deliver to traders in overcoming hurdles created by government regulators. What are those hurdles more specifically, and how do stablecoins help with that?
Well, for example, a lot of banks don't want to touch cryptocurrency and don't want to deal with it at all. And some regulations make it very difficult for them to do so. There are some banks that would like to deal with cryptocurrencies and that are attempting to be able to become able to do so, but they need to have access to the Federal Reserve. If a firm has access to the Fed that's a cryptocurrency exchange, then it can use the Fed's rails like any bank to get fast payments, relatively fast payments done with ordinary or more ordinary dollar IOUs. And there are many firms that would like to do this. They'd like to back those IOUs with pretty safe, and if not absolutely safe, assets. But if they don't have access to the Fed, none of them does, then they can't do that. And the other thing the Fed has done is to be very slow in encouraging the establishment of so-called real-time retail payments. That's payments that can be done instantly, which is what these cryptocurrency traders want and what they can do with stablecoins. They want payments that can be done quickly, any time of day, any time of the year. We could have that in our ordinary payment system, and we do to a limited extent thanks to a private innovation called RTP, which is a private clearinghouse organization that has set up a system that's growing in importance. But it took a long time for our regulatory officials to encourage that development. And then the Fed decided, once this private network was getting going, that it was going to jump in and have a rival network, which had a chilling effect on people signing up for the private network. And it created a sort of a problem of a decision problem. Do we join this network, or do we wait for the Fed? Will the Fed allow the private network to survive? So one way or the other, we have not provided some of the services. Our legacy payment system doesn't offer some of the services that people dealing in cryptocurrency value and need. And so it has contributed to the creation of this stablecoin market, where the stablecoins do what those people want. And the premium on stablecoins, which is, it's common for them to have, trade at a premium, not at a discount, reflects the special payment services that they provide that, say, ordinary banks can't.
George Selgin is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and director emeritus of Cato's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.